So I want to continue with this theme of investigations. So we've talked about experiential investigations, sort of going beyond what is familiar, or actually it's going beyond sometimes what is comfortable for us. And I think we need to put that piece in with the familiar, that we're not always so encouraged to sort of step beyond a little bit what feels entirely comfortable for us. So I think investigation is also an invitation to be prepared to be a little bit uncomfortable at times. And not, it's not encouraged to have a sort of mortification practice, but sometimes, you know, breaking out of the habitual and the familiar is not necessarily initially a pleasant experience. It can be disquieting and unsettling. But I think that needs to be surrounded, obviously, with a lot of mindfulness, a lot of care, a lot of compassion. But I think it is really true that we have to be prepared to be slightly uncomfortable in moments in this path. Now, I know that's hard because I think often we feel uncomfortable plenty in our lives. You know, and, you know, we would hardly undertake this path if it was an invitation just to be more uncomfortable. But I don't mean uncomfortable in terms of, you know, physical pain or anything like that. I mean uncomfortable in being willing to have our notions or our positions of selfing a little bit disquieted, or to have a little bit challenged our ideas about what is impossible and what is possible for us. I think there is a call in this path, in this teaching, to certainly extend ourselves a little bit beyond what is known and familiar. So we talked about that experiential level of investigation. I was also talking just before the walking period about the need to link that investigation, that clear comprehension, with the teaching of liberation. That there is a point to it. It is an informed investigation, an intelligent, mindful investigation. Now, the third aspect of investigation, which I think is very important and often neglected, is the element of wise discernment, or what is called discriminating wisdom. Vichaya is sometimes translated as discernment. So what are we discerning? What are we discerning? Now, again, this pushes the envelope a little bit because we are so afraid of being judgmental that I think we often pack discernment away. But it is necessary. So what are we discerning? A lot of this we've talked about. What is ennobling? What is not ennobling? What is conducive? What is not conducive? What leads to liberation? What leads away from liberation? Again, this quality of discernment is part of taking bewilderment out of the process. Now, discernment is not the same as judgment. I know this has become another one of these incredibly charged words in our world. You know, you would do anything not to appear as being judgmental. You know, it's like the greatest spiritual accusation. You know, you're being judgmental. Let's please just kind of put that word aside, because usually the way we're referring to the word judgmental is simply aversive-laden thinking, okay? That's what we're calling being judgmental. It's aversive-laden thinking. Now, vichaya, or discernment, is of a different order. So we have to remember that wise investigation is always preceded by wise, you know? As all of these links, so you have to put the wise in front as being part of the package. So wise investigation is actually looking backwards to wise mindfulness, which in turn is looking backwards to ethics. But wise investigation is always also looking forward and is the foundation of wise effort, energy, and wise action. Okay, it's a linking factor. So investigation, as I mentioned, is an enabling factor. Now, this really, I think, is what has major implications not only for our meditation, for our lives. Have you ever had the accusation leveled at you that somehow meditation is a kind of narcissism or navel-gazing or, you know, self-centered activity, you know, because you're sitting on a cushion? Well, I guess it could be, but I don't think that's wise, meditation. Because it is about, it is relational about how we are in the world. So I think it must be evident to us that wise discernment is the basis of wise choice. And we should never convince ourselves or try to convince ourselves that we are not making choices in this life. The acts and the avenues we choose to nurture and deepen, and those that we let go of, the words that we choose to say, and those we choose to restrain. Discernment is the basis of what we are choosing to feed and nurture, and what we're choosing to fast. On the basis not of a puritanical view, you know, of right and wrong, but on the basis of understanding directly what causes suffering and what brings suffering to an end. And I'm going to repeat that endlessly, you know, like some sort of broken record. But I think what is valuable to see, it is investigation and discernment that rescues mindfulness from passivity. Outwardly and inwardly. It's discernment is what makes mindfulness engage with the whole of our lives and lays the foundation for wise effort. If I walk out of here and see someone kicking a dog, that dog is not helped by mindfulness alone. Think of how many situations in your life where you are asked to say no to injustice or unwholesomeness or unskillfulness. Mindfulness alone does not do that. It is mindfulness linking with discernment, which is then linking with wise action. If you see and appreciate some of the intractable nature of some of our habitual patterns of judgment and anxiety, mindfulness is the first step, but it is not the only step in engaging with those intractable patterns. What is a tendency but simply an often repeated habit? Asking for more than just seeing. How do we bring about the end of some of the tendencies we see in ourselves that are so difficult? You know, tendencies of anxiety, of blame, of ill will. How do we stop repeating them? Most of us would like to stop repeating them. How do we stop repeating them? Because we engage with them. We know what it means to stop feeding them. We know what it means to fast them. We know what it is helpful to feed. How do we engage with suffering in any form? I mean, if you look back to the time of the Buddha, it's so clear that the Buddha was an activist. You know, he didn't just look at the caste system or look at the injustices in Indian society or the culture around him and say, you know, seeing. He engaged with wise action, with wise response. Mindfulness was relating to discernment, which is relating to wise action. There was nothing passive about it. Otherwise, the Buddha would have just retired to a cave. It is discernment that equally engages mindfulness with compassion and with kindness. It is an enabling factor. We would hope to see some outcomes of of mindfulness, investigation, and discernment. And the outcomes that we would hope to see is the dropping away of everything that is not conducive to our well-being and not conducive to liberation. I would just like to really encourage you, because I know, you know, you get so much encouragement not to strive and not to have goals or expectations and all of that. So I would like to be this sort of other voice for a moment and say, have expectations. You know, have expectations of your practice. Anticipate that there are outcomes. Aim even for those outcomes. With wise effort, with wise energy. But if you look at this path, the whole path is peppered with outcomes and goals. There is nothing passive about it. You know, aspiration is encouraged from day one. And the aspiration that is encouraged is to see the dropping away and the falling away of what is unhelpful and the maturing and the fruition of what is helpful and liberating. This doesn't mean, you know, this is not an invitation to become incredibly busy and have big projects, you know, and big agendas. But it is actually seeing, you know, we do not do this to stay the same. We don't do this to stay the same. And it is, you know, when I speak to people who've been practicing for a while, you know, it is amazing to me how reluctant people are to acknowledge maturity and fruitions, you know. If I actually speak to people who've been practicing for a time, they will say often, you know, many things about, yes, you know, I'm much more patient, you know. I'm actually much more inclusive. There's a much more readily access to compassion. Yes, I do find myself drawn towards calmness rather than intensity. You know, people can mark the falling away of what is unhelpful and mark the maturing and the fruition of really what is very healing and liberating. And I think it is, you know, we don't need to be allergic to that or to fear that that's going to lead to some inflated sense of self. It doesn't automatically follow. You know, and quite frankly, everybody needs fruitions in this practice. You know, what brings you back to the cushion, not for another dose of suffering and angst and struggle, you know, what draws you back to the cushion because you can actually acknowledge and celebrate and honor, you know, making, may I use this word, progress on the path. Making progress on the path. And I think that, you know, the inspiration is very important for us in this practice. And the dropping away of what is unhelpful and the maturing of what is helpful really is actually another piece here. You know, it's not geographical, it is actually born of your efforts and your intentions. You know, and I think that's also an important piece to acknowledge. It's not because it belongs to IMS or Spirit Rock or, you know, Cloud Mountain. You know, you could sit there for weeks on end, you know, like a mushroom on a log, you know. But if you actually bring the intentions and the efforts and the energy, you know, that is actually what leads directly to any maturing in your practice that you see. And it is actually useful to acknowledge that. That this is inwardly generated, not externally generated. Don't be so afraid. I think we can be almost overly afraid of the pitfalls of pride and striving and ambitiousness, and we will see the effects all too quickly if that is there and if it is unskillful, because we will not feel freer or lighter or more spacious or more understanding. But don't be so afraid of the pitfalls that we are reluctant to acknowledge, you know, some of the maturing that happens and how it happens. Not magically, but through the development of sati, through the development of discernment, through the development of investigation. And I think we begin to see that we don't just have a practice, but that we are on a path. And that there's a difference between those two. Now, the last aspect of investigation is reflection. It's reflection. You know, and sometimes I think, you know, in our culture, you know, sometimes we're very well trained in memorizing or learning and using our minds for sure. But we're not always so well trained in reflection. You know, and you know, personally, you know, I think sometimes people get this idea that sometimes, you know, meditation is a kind of anti-thought club. You know, and they're really meditating when there's no thought. Well, quite frankly, try and get through your life without thought. You know, and I personally, you know, I find that I have no interest at all in teaching people not to think. But I really have a lot of interest in teaching people to think well. You know, and reflection is part of that, and I think we need to somehow to almost learn to train ourselves to reflect and to know the difference between reflection and obsession. Mm-hmm. And there is a difference. You know the difference because reflection is something where that you have the freedom to put down. An obsession, that freedom to put it down doesn't feel available at all. But also noticing that because we are more prone to obsession, that sometimes we can to begin to reflect and it turns into obsession. That's actually not a problem. That's the moment we know to put it down, but it's not then the encouragement to abandon reflection as a lost cause. It's as much a practice as any other part of the practice. Now, there's kind of like, there's a couple of areas of reflection. One is reflection on the teaching, but the other is a reflection on the application of the teaching to our own lives and into our own lives. You know, is, you know, what you're hearing here this weekend, is it true in your experience or not? You know, is it helpful to your life or not? What does it mean for you? You know, I think, do we examine these questions? You know, the question of non-self. Do we reflect on our understanding of that? You know, do we reflect upon our understanding of clinging and identification or not? You know, do we reflect on our understanding of kindness and compassion? Do we actually reflect upon the teaching in the context of our own experience? Because this is actually a big piece of what removes doubt. It's a big piece of what removes wavering. And I know, you know, many people don't have so much of an inclination to study or to read the suttas. But we mustn't think that this is just some sort of, you know, intellectual exercise of discourses. You know, in the early days of my practice, I used to read the suttas as a cure for insomnia. Now they would keep me awake. Now they would keep me awake. Because there is something about the elegance of the teaching, I think, in its original forms, which is deeply inspiring. To reflect on it. What does this mean for me? Investigation is... I talked about this a little bit last night. I talked about the sort of different domains of desire. You know, that one of the domains of desire is, of course, what we've talked about a lot, you know, craving, tanha, unquenchable thirst. Then there's the other domain of desire, which is chanda, which is all the wholesome aspirations, you know? The longing for peace, the longing for compassion, you know, the longing for understanding that brings us to the path. And there is another dimension of desire, which is said to be the outcome of genuine reflection and investigation, which is samvega. And that translates as spiritual urgency. Spiritual urgency. And I think the whole point of investigation is actually to awaken samvega. We can fool ourselves that we have a lot of time. We might not. You know, we can think tomorrow is a better day to be awake. It might not be. You know, the whole kind of thrust of reflecting upon unsatisfactoriness and suffering and pain is not to depress us, but it is to encourage the awakening of this quality of samvega, this quality of spiritual urgency. Sometimes, you know, that gets awakened by conditions in our life, doesn't it? I mean, if you lose someone you love dearly, you know, or, you know, your world crumbles unexpectedly, or there's, you know, something falls apart that you hadn't anticipated. You know, for many people it's like, you know, take me to a monastery type feeling, you know. The urgency to understand, the urgency to make peace with. But I think what is encouraged, you know, and that's a taste of that samvega. It's very valid, you know, it's very valid. You feel almost startled into wakefulness. You know, it's almost, you know, sometimes it can just be seeing some terrible image of suffering on a television screen or on the street. You know, that you feel startled into wakefulness. But I think it's a taste of samvega. You know, you don't feel in those moments that, you know, tomorrow's a better day to be compassionate. But I think in this teaching, this tradition, that it's really encouraged not to leave that sense of being startled into wakefulness to conditions. But actually to cultivate it within our own hearts through a genuine investigation, through a genuine reflection, through a wise mindfulness, to come closer actually to the rawness and the unpredictability and the fragility of this life, and then decide what to do with our time and decide what to do with our attention. Which brings us to the next link. But before we move on, does anyone have any questions about investigation? No? We good? Yes.
I don't think I know how to investigate.
Sometimes. I mean, you know, I think there's two levels to that. One can be to do with our kind of personal story, and one can be to do with the more universal story. You know, for example, you know, on the personal level, you know, when we do often see the repeat visitors, you know, the returning thoughts, the returning stories, the returning obsessions, you know, clearly, you know, the nature of that, part of it can be habit, but part of it can be that there's something that we are really not at peace with, that we're really not at peace with, that we really don't understand. And the time to investigate that is not in the moments when we feel most compelled to. You know, when we feel this sense of, I really need to know what's going on here. The time to investigate that is in, because if you do that in the times when you feel that sense of haste and urgency, it's most likely that your investigation is already going to be colored by the mind state that is there. And so you'll probably end up going around the same loop again. But the time for that investigation is probably the calmest moment in your day, you know, when it's not even there. And you take a moment to be still in a spacious way, and you almost bring this kind of loop into mind and just ask, what does this need? What does this need? Just sit with the question. You know? Because you're trying to encourage a more intuitive understanding rather than a habitual one of retelling or explaining the story. What does this need, you know? What is sticky within this? What is being asked to kind of let go of? On the more universal level, I think there's a lot to be said for taking a kind of reflective theme into our lives, both on a conceptual level and on an experiential level. For example, you could take the theme into your life, for example, of impermanence for a week. Wake up in the morning, have it posted on your fridge. Notice what changes. Notice beginnings. Notice endings of a sound, a trip, a telephone conversation, a sensation. Notice what begins and notice what ends. And just really, kind of just really stay close to the theme. You know? Take a little time to reflect. What are the implications of those beginnings and endings in my life? Sit with that question. See what arises. See what comes. Notice when you start to kind of like flip into a more kind of, oh, you know, I know this type mind, you know, and deliver all the right answers, you know. Put it down for a while. But maybe bring it up again. What does this mean in my life? What does this mean? What are the implications? You know, perhaps take the theme of aversion and kindness. Stay with it for a period of time, days. Mm-hmm. Get up in the morning, let that intention sit down in the background of your attention, or of wise speech. Let it just sit down, sit as an intention in the background of your attention. Keep coming back to it. How do you know what is wise speech? How do you know what is unwise speech? To just stay with it in that sense, in a way you're kind of sort of feeling your way into the landscape of it. But there's something about sustaining the attention quite consciously and intentionally that I think is really a big part of reflection and reflective investigation. So it's not just kind of thoughts that are triggered by circumstances or by conditions or whatever. But it's very consciously brought into your field of attention as an intention, both intellectually and experientially. And I think it's really, you know, it's kind of a meditative, it's why they used an oral tradition, you know. It's a meditative skill as much as being mindful of breathing or mindful of your body. It's a meditative skill. And I think there's a very tangible felt sense difference between what is a kind of mindful reflection and what is kind of, let's just spin in a few thoughts. You know, I think the felt sense, it's calmer. It's undemanding. It's not filled with insistence. It has more of a sense of curiosity rather than I know the answer to this. And as I say, I think it is as much a meditative skill as anything else. You know, and really should be approached in that way. And it, you know, it's not obsession. There's much less repetition. Obsession is featured by repetition. Reflection is not. Okay, should we talk about energy? Put the sama, wise, in front of it. Wise energy. Virya. The most accurate translation in English of virya is heroism. It's the most accurate translation of energy is heroism. interesting, isn't it? It's related to the putting forth of effort, of focusing energy, of how our energy is focused. Now, there's a whole spectrum of nuances within this Pali word, virya. It includes courage, includes fearlessness, it includes perseverance, it includes patience. It is often mentioned the word ardency, enthusiasm, passion, dedication, commitment. All of those nuances are within the word virya. So any ideas that we had about, you know, meditation being this sort of passionless undertaking is very much contradicted by how the word virya is used in the discourses. Clearly it is, and virya is an antidote to sloth and torpor. It's an antidote to doubt and indifference. And wise effort forms part of this fabric of virya, which is clearly an awakening factor. But it's bigger than wise effort. I think in the Tibetan tradition, it says that the essence of virya, or the essence of wise energy, is finding joy in undertaking and cultivating the wholesome and skillful actions, thoughts, and words. So there's a very, very strong link between energy or virya and joy. Joy both instigates enthusiasm and energy, and energy and enthusiasm instigates joy. These two are very closely linked. We are not encouraged to undertake this path with a sort of cold sense of motivation or intention. It is intended to be joyful. And you can see in many of the different lists where this word virya appears. It's one of the paramis, or part of the fabric of compassion, heroism, fearlessness, perseverance, energy, very much part of the fabric of compassion. It's one of the factors of awakening. It's one of the spiritual powers. It's one of the links in the Eightfold Path. And in reality, it is the mental factor in wise effort. Yeah? It's the mental factor in wise effort. It's directly linked to our capacity to cultivate concentration. And it supports mindfulness. In fact, we all need it. And we need it in every aspect of the path. Energy is in the paramis, is looking backwards to wisdom. So insight is stimulating energy. And it is looking forward to patience, because patience rescues energy from being sort of wild and rampant and demanding. In the factors of awakening, as we're talking about here, virya is looking back to investigation, to samvega, you know, this spiritual urgency, spiritual wakefulness. This is meant to be evoked. The result of that is meant to be manifested in virya, this energy, this aliveness, and it is looking forward to joy. I think we recognize how much energy it takes, not only to cultivate the path, you know, to find your way to a cushion, you know, to find our way to a walking path requires quite a bit of energy and effort. I think it takes an enormous amount of energy and effort to embody insight. I think it takes really a great depth of energy and effort to swim against the tide of habit. And I think it takes a great deal of energy and effort to be upright in the face of adversity. In the Paramis, as I mentioned, how much virya is part of the fabric of compassion, it opens the field of our practice to practice for the welfare and happiness not only of ourselves, but for the welfare and happiness of all beings. And it is the motivation that allows, it is the motivation to practice for the welfare of all beings and not just for ourselves. It's what allows energy not to falter in the face of more personal goals, where success and failure, gain and loss, really often occupy the reigning seat. Do you notice that in your practice? Things are going well and hunky-dory. We're all motivated to turn up. You know, things are more difficult. How quickly motivation disappears. You know, and there is something in this quality of motivation in which it really is a part, which is really not about success and failure. It's not about gain and loss. It's not about short-term realizations. It's actually about really knowing what the path is about, not only for ourselves, but for all beings. If you notice how inspiration falters, you know, is strong in the face of good experience, and falters in the face of difficult experience. And I think it's really important to look at where energy falters in our own practice. You know, where this quality of kind of heroism. We use very inflated words in this teaching, you know, heroism, nobility, you know. Oh, these quite big words, you know. But where does it falter in your own practice? You know, when do you find yourself not practicing? When do you find yourself giving up? You know, when do you find yourself sort of turning away and finding that there's much more interesting things to do than to be present? You know? Are much more attractive things to do than to be present. You know, the times when we don't feel like we're getting anywhere. Times when our practice feels quite dry. You know? Quite desert-like. I mean, is that true for you? You know, what is it that sustains your effort? What is it that sustains your energy in those times? It's not just the actual experience. You know, this is dry. It's dry. Mm-hmm. But isn't it true to have a bigger sense of aspiration and a bigger sense of your practice and a bigger sense of really what it's dedicated to, which is not just about these changing experiences? Everybody has dry times in practice. Everybody has rich times in practice. You know, sometimes it's just the way it is. But sort of heroism or virya is something not just being kind of adjusted or altered by these kind of changing experiences, but a deeper sense, I think, of samvega, of compassion, of motivation, of where our practice is going. I would really encourage you to notice the links between interest, intention, and energy. Because if you notice when there is interest, we pay attention, don't we? When we're interested, we pay attention. When we're interested in something, we have the intention to pay attention. And if you notice that when we pay attention and when there's the intention to pay attention, there's actually quite a bit of energy there. There's actually quite a bit of energy in those moments. So I know sometimes when people are struggling with what feels like, you know, a lack of energy in their practice, I don't think it's something that you can force. But I think it's something you need to go back to this interest piece. You know, what am I interested in this moment? You can certainly see what you're really interested in because that's where you're hanging out. What am I really interested in? You know, sometimes that's the piece we've lost. We've forgotten why we're doing this. You know? We have forgotten why we're doing it. We've forgotten what actually captures our interest. You know, in Buddhist teachings, you know, this is a time when you get sent to the cemetery to practice. You know, or to the charnel grounds. It's true. I mean, that's sad. You know, when you read that in the text, you know, it always sounds like a very sort of aversive thing to do, you know, go practice in the charnel grounds or the cemeteries. I think the Buddha was right on, you know, like, interest is dropping, head out to the graveyard. Remember this fragile, unpredictable, changing life. Remember that postponement practice doesn't really work. Recover that sense of the dedication to being awake, you know, to the kind of freedom of our hearts. Wise energy, wise effort is so much of an antidote to heedlessness because, you know, it's what sustains mindfulness. You know, mindfulness is not endlessly self-generating. Wise energy, wise motivation sustains mindfulness. And it gets manifested in dedication. That's actually where I'm going to stop today, because tomorrow we have quite a lot more to do on wise energy. But I'd like to stop with kind of this thought about this relationship between interest, attention and intention and energy. To kind of just stop with that question and that kind of, yeah, just that question. To really notice that what, you know, what you're interested in, how there's an unforced attentiveness. And how there's a very unforced attentiveness, a very natural attentiveness. And, you know, I think about sort of like the early years of my practice, you know, when I trained in a different tradition, you know, before any of us were ever even given any meditation instructions or had any encouragement to formally meditate at all. It was this whole question of motivation and interest that was given all the time, you know. Endless teachings about, you know, why are you doing this, you know. Because I think there was really a sense that if our interest in practice was just a sort of trendy thing, you know, I'm curious about this sort of esoteric Asian tradition, you know, I think our teachers knew this was not going to stay. You know, that we would not be stayers. You know, we would be visitors to the path. You know, so much energy was given, you know, to these things like contemplations of death, like contemplations of interconnectedness, like contemplations on compassion, you know, for hours. Months. Months and months and months. Because I think this is the kind of, we need to orient ourselves. We kind of need to orientate ourselves about what we're doing on the path, you know, where it's going, what it means for us, what is important for us in our lives, because what we are interested in, we will have a natural attention given to.